All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry. I was a CW-2 helicopter pilot in Vietnam in 1969. And I'm still here. Yay. We've got a really interesting program for you today. Our guest is going to be Dr. Rebecca Grant. Most of you are familiar. She's been on our program many, many times. And we're going to be talking about what's going on in Iran. So stick around for that. And there's many other things that we're going to talk about. Not only what's going on in Iran, but also what's going on as a result of what happened in Iran. So as I said, make sure you stick around. You know all about Dr. Grant. But before we get into talking to her, we got to thank all of our sponsors and a couple of announcements real quickly. So as far as our sponsors are concerned, I want to make sure that we thank these major donors for their continuing support of Veterans Radio. We cannot keep this program on the air without their help. And so I'm going to give them a little shout out here. Number one is Legal Help for Veterans, specializes in veterans' disability claims. Call Legal Help for Veterans at 800-693-4800 or go to their website, legalhelpforveterans.com. The National Veterans Business Development Council, better known as NVBDC, is the nation's leading third-party authority for certification of veteran-owned businesses. For more information, go to their website, nvbdc.org, or give them a call at 888-237-8433. PuroClean is known as the paramedics of property damage. Each PuroClean office is independently owned and operated. In fact, PuroClean is one of the nation's leading restoration franchise networks and is made up of entrepreneurs just like you. And veterans get 25% off the franchise fee. So for more information, go to PuroClean.com. The Charles S. Kettles VA Medical Center in Ann Arbor, Michigan. For more information on the VA center here in Ann Arbor, go to va.gov/Ann Arbor Healthcare. And finally, we have the Irwin Prescorn American Legion Post 46 and the Charles S. Kettles Vietnam Veterans of America Chapter 310, both of Ann Arbor, Michigan. They have been supporting our program since we began in 2003. You can't do it without those guys. So if you would like to support Veterans Radio, please go to our website, veteransradio.org, and click on the donate button. Speaking of donations, I got to save the date here for you. Save the date for our Veterans Radio's annual fundraiser, Radio on the River. It's coming up on Sunday, September 28th, 1 to 5 p.m. Of course, this helps all those funds go to keep Veterans Radio on the air. We've got a couple of things going. We're going to have some music. Cool. We've got Lem Genovese, who is a veteran troubadour out there from the Vietnam era, plays a 12-string electric guitar. I don't know how you do that, but he's very, very talented. We've got another band coming. We're also going to be able to provide you with the opportunity to get a ride on a Huey helicopter. Yay. So the Michigan Flight Museum is going to be bringing out their Huey from the 240th Assault Helicopter Company in Vietnam. I'm very familiar with that organization. And you can purchase tickets to ride. And the cost, I believe, it has been in the past, is about $120 per passenger. And you get a 15-minute ride. And you never know. Like, they might even let me fly in the front seat. That would be scary, I realize, because it's only been, 50-some-odd years since I've flown a helicopter. I don't think you'll ever forget it. Sort of like riding a bicycle, right? Anyhow, for more information, you can go to our website, veteransradio.org, and we've got a banner ad up there. You can click on that and find out more information. So again, remember that. Sunday, September 28th from 1 to 5 p.m., we're actually going to be out at an organization called Freedom River this year. And Freedom River is located north of Ann Arbor. It's a great site. They're just finished building it. It's got all kinds of activities for veterans and their families. It's going to be having educational opportunities, benefit people going to be out there. All kinds of things are going to be there for you on September 28th from 1 to 5 p.m. So check it out. Thanks for listening. I also want to make sure that you We just got a message from Wreaths Across America that Veterans Radio is now being carried on WRGY in Rangeley, Maine. Pretty cool, huh? So we're in Rangeley, Maine now. We're also, obviously, we're in Ann Arbor. We're on WTTK, The Answer, in Detroit, Michigan, and KMET in Banning, California, with services Riverside and San Bernardino. So we're spreading, and because of people like you, we're able to do that. So I want to remind you that during today's program, if you'd like to ask a question, please give us a call here at 734-822-1600. 734-822-1600. If you don't want to come on the radio, send me your question by email. It's Dale, D-A-L-E, at veteransradio.org. Got it? Dale at veteransradio.org. Okay, I've got a little piece of music that I'm going to play here before we bring Dr. Grant on. So, Derek, whenever you're ready, go.
Oh, what's going on?
What is going on? So joining me on the air right now is our favorite expert on American foreign policy and all things military, Dr. Rebecca Grant. She is the vice president of the Lexington Institute, and she has been a national security analyst based in Washington, D.C. for many, many years. Dr. Grant, welcome back.
I'm glad to be back. Now, who is that artist? It sounds like Marvin Gaye.
Yes.
Right. But it's so true. What is going on? Dale, you and I often talk a little bit in the week before the show about possible topics. And this week, we didn't even have a moment to catch our breath. But it's clear what we have going on today. And that is the analysis of the incredible strike by seven B-2 bombers and a total of 125 U.S. aircraft participating on targets in Iran. You know, something that we've thought about, heard contingency planning for a long time, but maybe we never really thought it would come to pass, but it has, and the U.S. has indeed attacked an emergent nuclear weapons target site in Iran.
Right, and I think that the whole thing took many, many people by surprise. You know, as you said, this week was, you know, I'm sure it was a slam packed for you throughout the entire time. But, you know, the president had said that he was going to think about it for 2 weeks. And then, you know, a couple of days later, whammo. And that the Secretary of Defense had an article, I think I read this morning, that talked about that, you know, that this had been in planning for weeks and weeks and so forth. But I think that the actual event took everybody by surprise. And my concern about this whole thing is that some of the ramifications that could, you know, occur as a result of this.
Yes, as you say, in the Army, branches and sequels. Let me just rewind for just 1 week, because last weekend was June 14th, the Army's 250th birthday, which I know you covered, the parade in Washington, D.C., where President Trump was there, and he spoke just very briefly. And even then, there was speculation because the Israeli attacks on Iran had begun just a few days prior. But so that was on the Saturday. You know, on the Wednesday, we had President Trump in Canada for the G7 meeting, long scheduled, meeting with a bunch of new leaders, Britain's Keir Starmer, Mark Carney in Canada, who's new in the job, and then others that he knows well, such as Francis Emmanuel Macron and Giorgio Meloni from Italy, a group, by the way, that's been very involved in diplomacy with Iran around the nuclear program for quite some time. Now, Trump is there and scheduled to be there, and he leaves, you know, goes to a meeting, goes to the dinner, and he flies back overnight, right? Actually, he landed really early at Andrews Air Force Base. I was doing some live coverage and landed about 5 a.m., all because there were big matters to consider. So then for a few days, we were poised, thinking that something, action might be imminent, when President Trump then said, well, I'm going to give Iran 2 weeks. And I think everybody thought, wow, okay, it's going to be a little while. And then, of course, you know, looking back, what we know is that, in fact, that decision had been pretty nearly locked and loaded. Big clue was the deployment of somewhere between 25 and 30 aerial refueling tankers. Some of them did drag some additional fighters over into Europe and that region. You know, dragging is when the fighters fly alongside the tanker as they deploy forward. And that included some pretty top-of-the-line fighters like the F-22. But I'm told, you know, I think we'll hear more about this. Probably President Trump is very talkative. We could probably have a little bit more to say about it. But we're told that a real decision point here came as Trump was, again, offering a sort of an in-person meeting with the Iranians. You know, he originally had offered to send Vice President Vance and some others. It might have been Secretary Rubio, I believe, or someone. He was going to send a really very high-level delegation in addition to the 5 or 6 rounds of nuclear talks that had already been held. But apparently Trump had behind the scenes offered to go himself, probably to Turkey, our NATO ally, to talk with Iranian representatives. Seems like Iran's president, who's relatively new in the job, he's been there about a year, was okay with that. And I think the foreign minister as well, but they literally couldn't get Ayatollah Khamenei to sign off even on the meeting. Who knows, right, how that all works. You know, the Ayatollah is 86 years old, et cetera. And that, I think, may have led to some of this decision point. The ramifications, you just got to be thinking about it. You know, what is going to happen first, of course, protecting our U.S. forces in place in Central Command. And then I think kind of looking at what are the potential threats here. And then what are Iran's medium-term moves, such as potentially closing the Strait of Hormuz?
Right. And it sounds like they're thinking about doing some of those things. My question to you, Dr. Grant, is that in reading, you know, all the news this morning, and as I mentioned before, I know you've probably been talking with people about this all day, but is that one of the stories was that somebody representing Russia had said, well, you know, we can certainly help Iran, resupply their not their weapons, because I don't know if they've developed one or not yet, but certainly part of their, you know, their infrastructure for building the bomb, I guess you could say. And that, and also that China is kind of out there, you know, like they always are.
Oh, Russia. Boy, they just don't miss any opportunity to make an unhelpful, almost darkly humorous and horrible comment. Before this happened, Russia was trying to put their oar in to potentially negotiate and take away some of the highly enriched uranium. Now, the backstory here is that Iran actually does have a civilian nuclear power plant, perfectly normal. And, you know, you actually buy fuel from that on a global market. A lot of it's supplied from Russia. You don't make it yourself. So the Russians had built this plant for them, and I think they're planning some upgrades. So there's a pretty longstanding relationship there. And Russia is, in fact, a partner in that 2015 nuclear deal, which the U.S. Exited. But so unhelpful. I mean, I've seen statements with Russia saying, well, we'll just give them some nuclear warheads. I mean, you know, they're not going to do that, but that is the type of unhelpful thing. Don't forget, the Russians purchase Iran's Shahed drones, which they use on Ukraine. And they actually like these Shahed drones from Iran so much that they set up a dedicated production line in Russia to make the Iranian drones. So, you know, these countries are pretty close. And Russia has been no help at all in this situation.
No, because they've got their own deal going on with Ukraine, which has kind of been pushed way back on the, you know, on the news cycle as far as what's going on there. And in some article I read this morning, he said that, you know, well, we control all of Ukraine now. And we know that's not true, but he could say it.
You know, it's so true. There had been, when Israel's strikes on Iran started on June 13th, a few days later, there was another big Russian missile attack on Ukraine. There had been in early June, which now seems like a long time ago, you know, the record-setting levels of, I think the top was 499 drones with some missiles mixed in, shot from Russia against basically Ukraine cities. There's really no aiming at military targets going on here. And there were another couple of big attacks during the timeframe of Israel strikes on Iran and before the U.S. strike, and they hardly made even the sort of the defense trade press. And you got to feel a little bit for the Ukrainian people who are still putting up with this, and nothing is resolved, you know, in that situation. I think what happened here, though, was that, you know, President Trump had been very, very clear in his policy that, you know, Iran could not have a nuclear weapon. He says he'd give them a 60-day ultimatum. I think that's true. Again, something that the news, so much other news of the day, that we've kind of gotten away from that a little bit. But clearly, I think from a military, a tactical perspective, if you will, this was the moment when previous Israeli strikes had weakened, really decimated Iran's air defenses. And you talk about one of the key sites here is Fordow, the fuel enrichment plant. That was the big target, the big underground target. And it's been defended with Russian air defense systems since 2016. You know, interesting that the nuclear deal dates from 2015 and they put the air defenses up there in 2016. I tell you, it makes you wonder. Obviously, they were up to no good in there. This was a moment for them to attack. I think I was surprised by the scale of the B-2 attack. When I don't know if you were, but I was really impressed. The use of 7, that's pretty significant.
You know, I mean, I always think, I can't remember where I read it. We don't have that many B-2 bombers. Seems like they sent, you know, half of them over there.
That's exactly right. We have 19 B-2 bombers. Originally, 21 were built. The 21st, actually, which is, I think, one of the ones that's still flying, was never meant to. It was a test article, and it wasn't going to go to flyable status. You know, if you produce a military aircraft, usually the first several are for things like static fatigue testing, live fire testing, this and that testing, and they just generally don't even plan to put the, you know, the seat covers and the sentence strips and the rest of the avionics in there sometimes. But the Clinton administration actually decided to take this B-2, which was one of the, I feel like it might even have been Air Vehicle 1 or 2, incredible as that is, and turn it into the 21st B-2 just as well. So we have 19 of these. And the other thing is, this is a nuclear capable bomber. So while our forces aren't on the same nuke alert that they were in the Cold War, the B-2 wing, the 509th bomb wing, still has a nuclear mission. They have to be ready to provide aircraft into the triad if called upon to do so. In fact, their name, the 509th bomb wing, is a direct, is the wing that dropped the atomic bomb. And the number 509th was restored by the Air Force for the historical reasons and assigned to the B-2 wing to mark that heritage. So, you know, they've got to have it ready for that. And of course, you know, it's a plane, right? So there's always a few of them that are out for intermediate level maintenance, modification of this and that. You know, the planes they're about 30 to 35 years old. I guess the newest were done in about 97. So they're always out getting modifications. So you take subtract a few from that, you might have one that the new B-2 pilots are learning to fly on, and then you need 7 to go to a mission. It's incredible. Back during Operation Iraqi Freedom, the B-2 was used, and I think the maximum number ever used in one night was 3. So 7 is remarkable.
As I was mentioning when I was introducing you, Dr. Grant, is that you are, you know, you are heavily into all things military, and I'm really grateful for you to talk about this B-2 bomber, because I was saying B-2, you know, I remembered it, you know, in Iraq, Afghanistan, but I didn't realize how long ago it had been built, or, you know, initially, you know, went online, and then they bring out these bunker busters. So maybe you could help us with our audience explaining what a bunker buster really is.
Oh, yes, I'd be glad to. And you're right, I do have followed the B-2 for a long time, and I've been in this field for a long time. So there we are. The bunker busters are relatively new. You know, your listeners will know that the concept of heavy bunker buster ordnance really, I think they had some in World War I, but really dates from World War II. Strikes like the actually some of the attacks on some potential heavy water facilities in Nazi-occupied Norway, things that really needed heavy, heavy, heavy bombs. And in those days, heavy was 1 to 2,000 pounds or maybe a little bit more. The difference, and then we saw in the Gulf War, there was a 28,000-pound bomb that was actually pushed out of the back of a C-130. It's amazing what our Air Force can do. You would want to be holding on when you were pushing that thing out the back of the 130, used against American ingenuity, used against an Iraqi bunker in the time of Saddam Hussein. What's different with this new massive ordnance penetrator is really two things. One is the explosive material that's in the bomb itself. Let's go all the way to the other end of the spectrum. There's a bomb that's used quite a bit called the small diameter bomb, and it's a really small 250-pound bomb, but it's got the oomph of a much bigger bomb because it used to be the tritanol, but all that's the explosive material is considerably upgraded, so there's a lot more bang within a smaller footprint. That's different with the MOP. But the really key thing with a massive ordnance penetrator is actually the fuse. So they have, the fuses are programmable and they're smart. So it has to sense the penetration of the bomb body through layers of dirt and concrete, which obviously have dirt and concrete have different densities. And this fuse has to comprehend when it's entered an underground chamber where the underground machinery and factory complexes were at the Fordow fuel enrichment plant, and then detonate. So that is sort of the advanced technology behind the MOP. The B2 carries two, and you know, usually deal with bomb loadouts. It's not really the weight. I mean, the B2 takes on, I believe, 100,000 pounds of fuel in an air refueling, if you could imagine. So it's not the weight, it's the configuration of the bomb's fins and how they go in the bomb bay and how they go on the rack. Mm-hmm. So that means the B-2 is the one aircraft that's certified to carry two massive ordnance penetrators. It's been tested. We've seen a little bit of reporting here and there over the past couple of years, but really it's been developed, I'd say, really operationalized within just sort of the last sort of 5 to 7 years. And it's very much designed with exactly this type of target set in mind, Iran, or I think potentially North Korea as well, but I think specifically to get to these underground facilities, which the Iranians built to try to be impervious to air attack.
Right. I wonder, have you heard anything about the effectiveness of these bombs going off over there?
No, only what has been briefed first by President Trump on Saturday night, a very brief statement, and then by Secretary Hegseth and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Dan Kane this morning, that they are very happy with this. There is some satellite imagery out that shows six. I mean, they look kind of small because the area is it's sort of a desert, semi-arid area. So they say they're very happy with the destruction. They're obviously not going to tell us the details, which is too bad because we'd all really like to know. Yeah. I think they'll be watching for a couple of things. One is what the crews and the gun camera footage basically showed from the strikes. Then they do a lot of seismic sensing. There's a lot of nuclear related sensing. You know, the Air Force has a special plane that's configured to sniff out radiation in the atmosphere, all sorts of ways to check that. But I think most of all, they're going to see what the Iranians are doing up at that site. I mean, did a whole bunch of trucks drive up and they started shoveling out the entrance, or has nobody walked into that area at all? You know, that's going to be another, which they'll see from satellite monitoring. What is the Iranian posture around those sites? Ultimately, and the UN has said this already, Ultimately, Rafael Grossi, who is the man who heads the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency, he's a decent chap. He's been in that job a long time, hardworking Brazilian. And they're ultimately going to have to go in there and take a look. But that won't be for a while.
I think that was one of the questions was, that as a result of this bombing, did they release any radiation into the, into the atmosphere at all? And as you mentioned, they're not really going to be going in there probably for a little while anyway.
That's right. And that's the job of the IAEA. Grossi himself has been to the Zaporizhia power plant in Ukraine, which is like the biggest nuclear power plant in Europe. The Russians took it over, 3 years ago now and have been running it. So he's been up there to look and make sure the Russians are running it correctly. Horrible. I mean, what a job to have to do. So, and then of course the UN, I'm a little jaded on. I feel the UN hasn't really covered itself in glory in handling Ukraine and Iran and all this, but the IAEA does their best, and they are the ones who 2 years ago found that the weapons grade enrichment was indeed going on at Fordow, enriching up to 83% enriched uranium, and you need just 90% to make the bomb. So it was the certification by the UN, I think, that really has kind of begun this sequence, and they've also reported on other facilities. And it was, in fact, the UN's report from several days ago now saying that they felt Iran was not in compliance with, now wait for it, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which I think dates back to the 60s, which is when if you got a nuclear power plant built in your country, but you would sign the treaty pledging not to develop nuclear weapons. Most countries did that, and they have benefited from having nuclear power and all that comes with that. So the UN has certified Iran out of compliance with the NPT, obviously.
I would guess. I go back to this thing about, what the potential is. Let's talk a little bit about Israel and Iran, and I'm having to think that they had to work in conjunction with the U.S. When they started bombing Iran, and Iran started, sending rockets back, and it's like everybody starts throwing bigger and bigger rocks until we drop a really big one on them. One of the concerns was that Israel may be running out of their Iron Shield materials that we provide for them. Is that something you've heard?
People really are asking. They build some of the Iron Dome components on their own, and we supply some, and we've worked with them over the years on improving and upgrading that system. Who knows how their stockpiles are, rather. I'm sure they are getting a little bit low, but one hopes that they've sort of made some provisions to do that. This all really. The relevant context here, and again, it seems like it's been so long, but is really dates back to April of 2024. This to me is when everything changed, okay? When Iran launched the 300 missiles and drones against Israel in April 13th, 2024, and they did it again in October. And this was the unthinkable. Iran had finally attacked Israel, and Israel was able to shoot down, I think, actually all of the drones and missiles at that point, with help from our U.S. Navy, who did intercepts with destroyers and our Navy fighter pilots off the carrier, and with help from the Jordanians, because it goes across their airspace, and they have a really good air force. They don't like to be in the press, but they're very good, and they shot down a bunch of stuff, April 2024. So I think that attack by Iran on Israel, that just changed that whole relationship. And I think without, one sometimes hears, oh, this is Israel's war with Iran. Well, it was Iran that attacked Israel twice. Israel did a small attack in October of 2024, taking out some of the air defense systems around, in fact, some of the key nuclear sites, and then the campaign that we see now. The policy is clear, and in this case, Israel and the U.S. are not always in perfect agreement on every diplomatic item, but there was complete agreement that Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon. And Dale, I think the events of the last 10 days just prove that out completely. They don't have an understanding of, the Ayatollah does not have an understanding of deterrence in the way that we think of it here in this country. And they've made clear they're willing to attack anything.
Right.
And can you imagine, we have now, I think, probably very close to 50,000 U.S. forces across the Middle East from Syria to the two carriers on the Red Sea and a lot of bases in between. Can you imagine, they're there to contain Iran. Can you imagine trying to do force protection if there's 9 to 15 Iranian bombs in the mix? It's just, it's unthinkable. And I think the scenarios like that are what led the president to choose to carry out these strikes. It's very serious decision. I think it was a difficult decision for him, not one he wanted to have to do. But I certainly see the case for the military necessity.
Yeah, it's kind of unusual for us to, being in the U.S., to really take the initiative. And I mean, I know that the CIA and special forces and all those other things, they go and kind of find stuff out. And I'm sure that some of our troops were actually in Iran setting up their radars and directional things to help, get the jets in there. But I like you, I am concerned about those 50,000 American service people over there. One of the things that I heard this morning, of course, is that one way they could retaliate is to close off that, was it the Gulf of Hormuz?
Yeah, the Strait of Hormuz, that little
Yeah.
hook.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good
Well, good
look.
luck.
Hard to do.
But
Well, it's there.
it's a very narrow point. And it's funny, but their neighbor there in the waterway is the UAE, the United Arab Emirates. So they'll tell you they're only 32 kilometers away, the Iranians, And it's become so difficult for the more moderate states in that region to know how to deal with Iran. They all have a lot of business relationships. And the UAE and Iran, I think, share an undersea natural gas field, and they have trade relationships. But you just don't know how to talk to these people. And to me, this is the longer term ramification. Clearly, some of the recent force deployments are there to enhance force protection. I think General Kurilla at Central Command is, the force protection is extreme. They're watching for Iranian missiles. Our Space Force sees every Iranian missile launch. They're watching for drones. We have plenty of fighter jets there and other systems to take out drones. They're watching for just the RPG attacks that were from Iran-backed militias in Iraq that killed, I believe, 600 Americans during our time in Iraq. But the question here is, like, when do you get the Iranians to talk to you?
I don't
The
know.
Ayatollah is just, and he is in his own world. It is just so impossible to know how to handle that.
Well, it seems like, I mean, it's been infuriating, ever since they overturned the Shah. What was that, 79?
Yes.
Nobody's really been able to negotiate any sort of peaceful coexistence over there. I'm curious about what the other countries. I mean, you mentioned the UAE, but you got Saudi Arabia, you got Yemen, you got Iraq again. They're kind of in between Iran and Israel. So what's going to happen there? I mean, they had a bloody, bloody war, what, 25 years ago or so.
So such a good point. The Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s, the War of the Cities, the overspill of which led to the Kuwaiti tanker reflagging operation, President Reagan's attacks on some of the Iranian oil rigs out there in the water. That war was a horrible war involving chemical weapons, airstrikes, death on a large scale, and that had come really on the heels of Iran's 1979 revolution, as Iraq kind of tried to poke it at all this, and see. And they settled in the end, but it took, I believe, a full 8 years to settle it. And so I think what we're looking at here in our situation today, the other states in that region, they do not. Iraq, it's a little difficult because there's a lot of Iranian influence in Iraq and the politics and various things. And that's a result that has come about in the aftermath of of our war in Iraq. But most of the states in that region, they do not want war. They want to, you know, get back to business. They're horrified at Iran's terror activities and all this. Now, if it's, oh, you know, ideological message, whatever, that's the Iranians, Shias, they can live with it. But it's gotten to this point. So while they will not come out and say it publicly, I think there is strong, strong, strong regional support. They agree you cannot have a nuclear-armed Iran. And if you have Iran with a nuclear weapon, well, first of all, you have Israel really preparing its nuclear strike options. And you have Saudi Arabia potentially saying, well, we had better build a bomb as well. And it goes from there. So this is something that this strike, I believe, has avoided. So I do not know that we're going to get regime change. That is not an objective of these strikes. I don't know if Iran is going to become a better place. It's a big country, a lot of people, great history and culture, terrible economy, a lot of repression and unrest. But all that is always very unpredictable. What Operation Midnight Hammer has achieved is, for now, in Iran, without a nuclear weapon, and that was just the bare minimum we need to get by, not only in that region, but to continue to have any sort of world and global stability. And no thanks to China, who, as I've said so many times, buys 90% of Iran's oil and has kept them in business.
I was just going to mention them. You know, because I'm worried about the ramifications, you know, that our attention is, you know, so focused on the Middle East that some other things may be happening elsewhere, you know, like, you know, the North Korea stuff and, you know, the Chinese are building more and more ships and more airplanes and more of everything. And I'm not sure how, you know, how we can handle that, I guess, would be my concern there. And also, you know, if the Iranians, as you mentioned before, you know, I don't know how fanatical some of them are going to be, how many of the, you know, this is a conspiracy theory I'm making up as we go, but, you know, how many of the Iranians that are living in our country are, you know, like the sleeper people, and suddenly they're all going to rise up and do terrible things. So those are the things that I'm in talking to friends and so forth that people are mostly concerned about, is what is the retaliation, if any, going to be?
Well, two excellent points. And if you and I are sitting as part of Xi Jinping's inner circle in Beijing, the Americans flailing around with having to strike Iran and deploy all those forces, you know, since China's long-term plan is to take us down as a global power, stomp all over us, this works. So it's a terribly cynical view, but it's really an issue. It's something that in that bigger perspective, we really got to tamp this down in the Middle East and get out of there to a greater extent. Back to the issue about sleeper cells. So, you know, my view here is, first of all, I think Homeland Security, FBI, really all over this. But wow, some of the things Iranians have tried. And I think most of the Iranians that live here, you know, a lot came after the overthrow of the Shah. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of it's perfectly, you know, very civilized. Iran was a very civilized, advanced culture before 1979, right? It could be again. Right. But some of the things they've done. An Iranian was indicted for plotting to assassinate Ambassador John Bolton, who had been in the Trump 1 administration and a former UN ambassador. This was in 2022. We know that Iran has been plotting to assassinate Donald Trump and has threatened other leaders. Back in 2013, an Iranian cyberspace team hacked into a water dam in upstate in New York called the Rye Bridge Dam.
Oh, okay. Yes.
And got into its systems, the SCADA controls, and almost managed to turn the thing on and off, but they got caught. Again, FBI indictments on this. So certainly Iran has some cyber capabilities. I think they would love to try some sleeper type activity. Their doctrine is, this comes from the revolution period, is to strike. And that's why they built up Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis. This is their whole game plan, is to attack and build up chaos, you know, in the Middle East. They'll say, well, they're not going to do it themselves, but they're going to get all these other people to go and do this. But that's why they've built up this terror network. That's part of their national policy. It's incomprehensible. So there certainly is a risk, and I think that all the whole, see something, say something is very much applies. But I do believe also this has been in the wind a long time, and there's been a heightened security concern, frankly, since the October 7th, 2023 attack out of Gaza into Israel. And so I think the FBI and Homeland Security are all of this. No telling who came across the southern border,
I got a feeling
however.
they're going to be working overtime because I mean, Hezbollah said that they didn't want anything to do with America, at least in the short term, and so I'll be interested to see what goes on. I did just in an aside before I let you go here is, and I'm a little bit concerned about the advisors that President Trump has, because I don't see a whole lot of experience there. And I was just wondering what your thoughts were on that.
Oh, I hear you on that. And I will say one individual who I think really is the public is getting to know a little bit more now is our chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dan Kane. He had been an Air Force 3-star, a guardsman, I believe an F-16 pilot who flew combat in Iraq. And he had some time deployed there as a general in the Air Operations Center. And I think he'd met President Trump during the anti-ISIS campaign back in the 2017, 2018 timeframe. I've been very impressed with him. He actually did extremely well in his Senate confirmation hearing. He's very cool, man of few words, very level-headed. And in watching his Pentagon briefing this morning and just his general attitude, this is an airman who knows every bit. So when he says, "This was a real complicated strike package that we flew," he's flown those strike packages. He's planned them. He's commanded them. His expertise is actually exactly what was needed for Operation Midnight Hammer. And he seems to be that calm and collected and experienced. He's in a very significant job as basically the top military advisor to President Donald Trump. But in this case, General Kane certainly has ideal experience as an F-16 combat pilot with it. He just knows all the intricacies. You talk about air refueling for a 90 planes in a strike package. He knows that in his sleep. So I'm really glad that we have that advice there. I also think Secretary of State Marco Rubio has done a fantastic job in his two jobs as Secretary of State and National Security Advisor.
Okay, well, that's what I wanted to hear because I want to make sure we can all sleep at night.
That's right. And let's remember too, Iran has been weakened. I think the end game is very difficult, but the work that was done by the B-2s against the Iranian target set, this was the right thing to do. This was truly a danger, a real danger, and the danger of doing nothing was much, much greater. We let this go on far too long. This was the moment. It was done in a very serious spirit, and they had every chance to come to the negotiating table prior to that strike. But it is good that Iran is now not as close to a nuclear bomb.
Well, that's good news. That's good news for all us to hear. And I appreciate you taking the time out of your very, very busy day, I'm sure, to come here on Veterans Radio and calm some of our fears and let us know what really happened. And I'm looking forward to contacting you probably in the near future to see if we can figure out what the results of this whole thing were.
That sounds great. It's always an honor to talk to Veterans Radio. Thank you.
Thank you so very much. It's Dr. Rebecca Grant talking about what's been going on in the last day or two, and I'm really excited to. I was very excited to have her come on and talk about Operation Midnight Hammer. So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I've got some new news to talk about with you. So you're listening to Veterans Radio.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Captain Louis Millette was wounded by grenade fragments, but refused evacuation. Details after this.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans' Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
While personally leading his company in an attack against a strongly held Korean position, Millett noted that the
1st Platoon was pinned down by small arms, automatic, and anti-tank fire. Mallette ordered the 3rd Platoon forward, placed himself at the head of the two platoons, and with fixed bayonet, led the assault up the fire-swept hill. In the fierce charge, he bayoneted two enemy soldiers and boldly continued on, throwing grenades, clubbing and bayoneting the enemy while urging his men forward by shouting encouragement. Despite vicious opposing fire, the whirlwind hand-to-hand assault carried to the crest of the hill. His leadership and personal courage so inspired his men that they stormed into the hostile position and used their bayonets with such lethal effect that the enemy fled in wild disorder. During this fierce onslaught, Mallette was wounded by grenade fragments but refused evacuation until the objective was taken and firmly secured.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. We can all help someone going through a difficult time. Learn how you can be there for veterans. Visit veteranscrisisline.net. veteranscrisisline.net. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
And we're back here on Veterans Radio, and I hope that you enjoyed and learned a little bit from Dr. Grant. As I mentioned before, she's always willing to come on our program at short notice. And I, you know, with everything that's going on today, I wanted to really thank her for taking time out of her very busy schedule, I'm sure. If you go to television, not yet, if you go to the TV news, I'm sure you're going to see her on many different outlets this evening, talking about some of the same things that we talked about here. So as I mentioned, we are going to try and figure out when we can get her back on, or some other folks that we've been talking to over the years that will give us a little bit of insight as to what's going on, you know, in Iran. And as I mentioned, it is kind of frightening when you think about it. Nobody wants to get involved in another, conflict in the Middle East. Over the last 20 years, we, you know, another thing where we, you know, didn't necessarily have a plan when we went in, and we didn't have a plan when we got out, but I got to leave it up to the powers that be. So I'm hoping that they will do a good job and do what's right for all of us at that time. Here on Veterans Radio, as I mentioned, I had to let her go a little bit early. So I wanted to tell you what's coming up in the future. I already talked about our fundraiser coming up on September 28th. That's a great opportunity for us, and I'm really excited to be out at Freedom River. It's a wonderful place for veterans to go with their families to relax. They've got fishing, they've got boating, they've got, as I mentioned, they're going to eventually have training programs out there. For our Radio on the River thing, we're going to have all kinds of different organizations that will be available to you when you come out. The VA will be there. There's going to be some other organizations, women veterans and so on and so forth. We'll have booths there to show you. We're going to have a display of military uniforms and artifacts and so forth. So I think it's going to be kind of a fun day, and food and music. So what else did you have? Oh, and storytelling, because that's what we do, storytelling here on Veterans Radio. As a matter of fact, next week, I think we've got a really cool storytelling program coming up. We're going to be talking to a couple of Army nurses from Vietnam. The main speaker, or the main guest, is Sarah Plum, and she has written a book called Warrior Nurse, talks about PTSD and healing. And I just wanted to read a little bit from the back of the book, and because, you know, she was in an area that I was in Vietnam, and I think I probably flew over her hospital. It says that the 12th Evac Hospital in Cu Chi, Vietnam, Sarah Plum is an operating room nurse during the fighting in the Iron Triangle of 1967. The Iron Triangle is west of Saigon, west and northwest between the Parrot's Peak and so forth out in that area. So it said that mass casualties with severely wounded soldiers show up for Sarah and her fellow nurses, and the surgeons treat them in the midst of mortar attacks, monsoons, and exploding artillery. I've heard this story so many times from nurses from the Vietnam era. You know, we've all seen, you know, the television version of MASH. It wasn't like that. these men and women were in operating rooms sometimes 24 hours a day, you know, trying to put together and put back together American soldiers. They also took care of local villagers and kids, and even sometimes the enemy wounded would come through their hospitals. Her story is intertwined with a gentleman by the name of Johnny, who's hit by American artillery, and Jim, a baseball pitcher with multiple wounds, including his pitching hand. It encompasses her terror on the tarmac of Benoit Air Base on the day that she leaves, culture shock, emerging post-traumatic stress, assaults by protesters, being head nurse of an orthopedic ward at Madigan General Hospital up in Washington, I believe, and her growing awareness of the effects of war on her and her fellow soldiers. So next week, we are going to have her on the program with two other nurses from the Ann Arbor area who also were in Vietnam. They were further north. They weren't in Cochi. One was in Pleiku and one was in Phu Loi, I think. I don't know. I was down south, so I'm not familiar with all those places. But they're going to be on the program together to talk about really what it was like being a nurse in Vietnam. And you've all, I know that many of you have listened to our program where we talked about the book, The Women, which is a fictional story of nurses in Vietnam. And this is a group of veterans who have been overlooked for years and years and years. And I'm very happy to give them an outlet for their stories and just the admiration that the men and the women in Vietnam had for Army nurses and their docs, of course, is beyond the pale. They just did an amazing job daily. Every single day, they had to face multiple amputations, terrible, awful wounds and burns and everything else. So I encourage you to listen in next week. I think you'll find it a very interesting program. And of course, the following week, the first Sunday of July will be our benefits program. And we've got a new contact at the VA healthcare side of it. So we're going to be able to have someone on to talk about that. I know there are many concerns from our veteran community about what's could or, you know, may be going on at the VA hospitals around the country. So hopefully we're going to be able to talk about those, and maybe we can eliminate some of the questions that you might have and some of the concerns. I can't imagine that anybody's going to do anything too drastic to the VA system. Veterans, it can be a very loud group of people when they get upset. So I don't think they're going to want to do too much. I understand them willing to want to save money, and that's fine. And sometimes you've got to knock down the whole forest before you can, you know, replant all the trees. I'm hoping that they don't go to that extreme. But please just, you know, give everybody a moment to think about what is going on, because many of the cuts and budgets and so forth that were talked about for the last 5-6 months have been reinstated. And, you know, they're still trying to figure out a way to get us out of debt. And it's not going to be an easy task. So I'm trying to encourage people, my friends who, you know, might be on the other side to exercise patience, and we'll see what happens. So that's coming up, as I mentioned, the first Sunday of July. So again, I want to thank everybody for listening today. I know we've got time left to go, so I'll just keep going on here for 2 minutes as my sign is out there. I talked about Radio on the River. There are other fundraisers. Oh, I know. There's a great fundraiser for people here in the local area, in the Ann Arbor area, coming up on July 9th. It is a fundraiser for the Washtenaw County Vietnam Veterans Memorial, and it's going to be at the Freight House over in Ypsilanti. And I believe it starts at 5 o'clock. It's $20. Great music. Again, great food, great stories. It's so warm, heartwarming to see all of these veterans getting together and helping each other. You know, with the saying was, you know, when we were in combat that we had your back, and we like to keep that going now and saying that we have your back while you're here. So come on out and support the memorial. There's all kinds of organizations in your local area that are always looking for volunteers or always looking for some sort of donation that can help them meet their causes. There's dogs out there. There's all kinds of fundraisers of people marching and running and riding bikes across the country, trying to get people to realize that, you know, mental health are issues that need to be taken care of. We have a local guy here locally who is really promoting the 988 emergency number to be on all police cars, to be available for everybody. So, yeah. Join a group. Find some organization that meets your needs. And I think that it's so rewarding to be involved helping these men and women, now a younger generation of men and women coming up. So we got 10 seconds. So this is Dale Thornberry for all of us here at Veterans Radio. Till next week, you are dismissed.
God bless America, land that I love. Stand beside her and guide her through the night with the light from above. From the mountain to the prairie, to the oceans white with foam.